Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend Mike Farrell, actor, activist, and longtime leader against the U.S. death penalty. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin with a little short prayer, as we always do, and I just like to invite everyone, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and to relax and recenter yourself. And together, let's all just enter into the presence of the God of peace, who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone everywhere, and welcome the nonviolent Jesus with us. Just take a moment to ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully on the path of peace. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life and love and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to be peacemakers in our poor world, to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, heal us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part, to help end poverty, racism, greed, injustice, the death penalty, gun violence, war, fascism, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy peacemakers and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. It's a great blessing to welcome today my friend Mike Farrell, actor and activist and longtime leader against the U.S. death penalty. I think I met Mike in 1990 protesting U.S. military aid to El Salvador and also at the annual event for Death Penalty Focus. Of course, he's best known as one of the most beloved stars of our time in the hit TV show MASH in the 1970s and later Providence. He's also a writer, director, and producer of other TV films and has appeared in several movies. And for 3 years, he served as the first vice president of the Screen Actors Guild and later as a member of the Guild's National Board of Directors. Mike is president of Death Penalty Focus and also co-chair emeritus of Human Rights Watch in California and serves as a spokesperson for Concern America, which is a great organization that does refugee relief and development work. Mike has traveled the whole world for 40 years on international peace and human rights delegations, many times to El Salvador, Nicaragua. I'm going to read to you the places Mike has been: Honduras, USSR, Paraguay, Chile, Israel, Palestine, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Czechoslovakia, Somalia, Kenya, Croatia, Bosnia, Cuba, Rwanda, Zaire, Tanzania, Mexico, Costa Rica, and Samoa. He's really been at it for a long time, folks, working for justice and peace. During the Salvadoran Civil War, he visited the region many times and later testified against U.S. military policies and war-making there before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Mike helped establish the California Committee on Human Rights Watch and served as co-chair for 10 years. Later, in his work to stop the U.S. wars in Iraq, he co-founded Artists United to Win Without War. But mainly, I've known Mike as a lifelong opponent of the death penalty. As I said, he led Death Penalty Focus for 37 years, since 1988, I think, and speaks, debates, writes, and campaigns across the country in opposition to state killing. In particular, I'm so moved that he was involved in the campaign to abolish the death penalty in California, which has to be done by a statewide vote, and came within 2% of succeeding. And then later, I think in 2021, barely lost again. Mike has written a great memoir, which I recommend to everyone, called Just Call Me Mike, A Journey to Actor and Activist. So Mike Farrell, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Thank you. You're just exhausted.
I know. I'm exhausted, too. I don't know how you're doing it, man. So how does such a big, beloved Hollywood star of one of the biggest hits of all time, MASH, become a full-time anti-war, anti-death penalty activist? And I, as I told you, I I think there's so few. And I think of our friends, Martin Sheen and Ed Asner, who also did this. What happened to you, Mike?
Well, you know, I think back about, I got married in 64 originally, and marriage lasted a very short time. After 3 years, we split up, and I was really fractured by it, and just saw the kind of damage that I guess I had done to myself getting into that relationship, but also to my then wife, because I didn't know who I was or what I was doing. And a dear friend who was involved in a lot of things told me about a place, and he said, I want you to come here. And it's a, this was in the 60s. They called it the Manhattan Project. It was on Manhattan place in Los Angeles, and it was a halfway house, essentially. But it was a program involving people who had been in prisons and on the streets and in and out of different aspects of trouble in our society. And they were just kind of coming together to, under the leadership of some former addicts and reformed people who'd been in those situations, and a really terrific psychologist, and some people from the Salvation Army, of all places. And I just was stumbled in there because I was cross-eyed with fear and anxiety and not sure who I was and where I was going, and got into this program. And you have the capacity to edit this, I'm sure, John. So I'll say what was said. I was in a group therapy situation, and a guy said something. He was a tough guy, just out of prison, and he was really angry about something. And he said something, and I contradicted him. And he said, "Who the fuck are you?" And I said, "I'm Mike." And he said, "What the fuck is a Mike?" And I thought,
that's a good question.
That's worth thinking about. And I spent a year at this place and learned from the people who've been in the streets and in the jails and in the mental institutions and in the places that they've been. And that how convenient my life had been up to that point, and how easy it had been. And it kind of got me started on being involved in stuff. And I got involved with a lot of things locally. And then at the same time, I was trying to develop a career as an actor, and I was getting a little job here and a little job there. And things began to move along. And when I did a couple of television series before MASH, but once you do a television series, you know, the network wants to promote you, and they want to tell everybody who you are and why you're their star, blah, blah, blah. I worked with Brad Crawford on a show called The Interns for a year, and then with the great Tony Quinn on a series for another year. These were not long-lived series, but I had opportunities to, you know, mix it up with some really extraordinary talents. And then, sort of out of the blue, MASH happened, and suddenly, you know, reporters wanted to know who I was and why I'd done this and why I'd done that. And I just figured, what the hell, I'll just tell them who I am and what I've done and stuff. So it doubles on itself. the press, you know, I got involved with in an international discussion debate with I forgot their name, the woman in Florida, the orange juice woman in Florida, who was anti-gay, Anita Bryant. Thank you. Yeah. And we had a sort of debate via television interviews, and a guy I knew contacted me, and he said, at that point we had a proposition on the ballot that was supposed to stop gay people from being teachers in our schools, and I opposed it. And he contacted me and he said, look, I'm gay, this guy, and he said, but if I have a straight man with me that the public knows campaigning, it will make the difference. And I said, okay. So we got involved. I got involved in that campaign. Before that, I'd been involved in things with down in the barrio and in the black communities and stuff with some of the organizations. So I'd, you know, been kind of blooded, if you will. Worked with Operation Bootstrap in downtown LA and stuff. So, but you know, television debates were kind of new to me, but I got involved in that, and one thing tends to lead to another.
And you became an activist then, right?
Yeah.
So let me ask you about, we don't have to talk about MASH, but were you always against war? And then suddenly during the Vietnam War or after it, you're in the leading show, which is about war. Do you think MASH helped turn people against war, and that films can do that? And how did your anti-war work lead to, I'll ask you, Lynn, about anti-death penalty work and human rights work? Or do you see it all as one big mess, one big culture of violence? Maybe say about some of those things.
Well, to answer the first question first, no, I was not always against war. I grew up in West Hollywood and thought that the Marine Corps, you know, Marines were fighting in, certainly in Korea, but I knew all about the Marines. I thought the Marines were great. So I joined the Marines right out of high school and I was stationed in Okinawa for a while and in Japan for a while. And I learned about there wasn't everything was cracked up to be. But it came out of it a little more educated about the whole issue. When I was in Okinawa, we were stationed in an area that was near a village that was a no-go village because they were supposedly communists. So I went over there to sort of engage in conversations and find out that they were just people, you know.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so the education came slowly, I will say.
There were a lot of episodes in MASH like that, where you're just meeting people. As I recall, when I was in college watching MASH with
MASH happened, you know, and it was very much a show that was about war and about against war. And Larry Gelbart was one of the great spokespeople, I think, writing the scripts he wrote, and the rest of the writing crew, of course. But the show was very clearly anti-war, and we were all thrilled to be making these statements.
Oh, that's so great to hear, Mike. Okay, I want to ask you about Central America, because I think that's, for you and for millions of us activists across the country, when a lot of us, after Vietnam and all, really deepened our commitment against war and into activism in general because of what was happening, what the U.S. was doing in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and still doing. We're recording this just after we kidnapped the president of Venezuela. So you campaigned in the 1980s. We have Oscar Romero killed, and you were going to El Salvador and Central America and went many times and got involved in a lot of groups, and that led, I guess, to Human Rights Watch and others. I wanted to ask you, in general, just to talk about those years, but in particular, I don't know if you remember, but I had lived there in 1985 under the direction of the six Jesuits who were later killed. They were my friends.
Yes.
And they sent me out into the war zone. And so I was going two or three times a year for 15 years. Did you know them? That's my little personal question for them.
I did. I met them.
Air Korea? And was,
yes, yeah. I met them and was devastated when they were murdered.
Yeah, we all were. Yeah.
That started because of... I had met the people running Concern. You mentioned Concern, American organization I've been a spokesperson for.
It's a great group, Robert.
Yeah, they are a terrific, fabulous group. And they asked me if I would become their, I was at that time one of the stars of MASH, and you know, you could get them press, if would I be willing to be their national spokesperson? And I said, yes, but I'd like to see the work you're doing first.
Uh-huh.
So I went to the Thai-Cambodian border where the Khmer War was happening in Cambodia at the time, and the Khmer Rouge. And the Concern people were working in the camps that the UN had set up on the Thai-Cambodian border. And I was able to go into Cambodia and see with a couple of people from the organization, and not only into the camps and see the camps and see the work that they were doing there, but into, you know, see the there was a program where farmers from inside the state, the country, would come out because their products had all been destroyed by the Khmer Rouge, and they would get food and get seed and get stuff from the United Nations. It was a quite extraordinary program to see.
Wow.
And that then sort of embedded me with Concern. Yeah. And then they asked me to go into Central America, where what asked if I would. They had a truckload of equipment, medicine, and stuff that had to be distributed to some of the refugee camps for Salvadorans in Honduras. And so I went down there and drove the truck up to a number of the camps. And I remember we had a number of big bags full of stuff. And one of the bags, as we parked and we were distributing it to the people, young men grabbed one of the bags and just took off down the road. And I looked at them, and I looked at the person who was running the camp, and I said, with my eyes, raised the question with my eyebrows, and she nodded her head, and I said, okay. And off they went to the border, and they were taking the stuff to Charlie Clements, who was the doctor, who was
Charlie Clements
on the other side of the border. So we were, you know, it was just a great education.
It sure was. Yeah.
So, and then we drove down into Managua to see, there was a big thing going on in Nicaragua, obviously, with this Sandinistas, and the Reagan administration was trying to destroy them. And we went out to look at the Contra camps, took a helicopter out to see the mosquito situation, the mosquito Indians on the East Coast. Anyway, so, and that started my association with Salvador, and I was back three or four times, I don't know, for human rights delegations, just to meet with and to talk to these incredible people, you know, go in and visit people in the prisons and listen to the stories of torture and hideous behaviors. And anyway, so I was there, I don't know how many times, and I'm thrilled to meet the priests, and so stricken to hear about their murder. It was just disgusting. I remember when we met with them and talked to them, it had to be under cover. It couldn't be known that we were there.
Right.
I'm sure you realize saw the same thing.
I've had that many times.
But it couldn't be known that they were meeting people and giving information.
Right.
And we were so. So I felt kind of complicit when they were murdered. I thought, God, I hope on some level, well, you know, you feel wounded by it, but you also feel responsible. You know, I was able to leave. I was able to fly out and go back to the States, and they chose to stay and face what they faced. It kind of tears at you.
And it led to some of the most focused activism in U.S. history that actually ended U.S. military aid to El Salvador in 1990. And that's when I met you. L.A. was having the week. I was traveling the country every day. We had those weekly demonstrations. But thank you for all that great work. Now, meanwhile, you're traveling the country and you're still acting and you're in and out meeting these mythic people in Central America, not to mention around the world. And there you are with Death Penalty Focus from 1988 with our great friend who just died, Father Chris Panette. And you've remained a faithful leader and a voice calling for the abolition of the death penalty for, 37 years. How did you get involved in that? But tell our listeners about Death Penalty Focus. Presume they don't know about it.
Sure. Well, DPF is one of the largest abolition organizations in the country. We're based in California and have been focused on California's death penalty, but it's a nonprofit 501c3 educational organization that reaches out to people and lets them understand. And we provide speakers and we travel and we have had demonstrations whenever there were executions in California. We were always there at the gates. And inside death row, meeting with the people when we could. But it happened because I had always sort of thought the death penalty didn't make any sense. But I wasn't an activist per se. But when the first execution in California in some dozen years, I think, was a young man just a terrible situation, and I'm blanking on his name right now, of course, but he was the first executed, I think, 15 years after executions had taken place for some time. And I did a press conference or two with some people and talked about the wrongheadedness of killing this fellow and how urgently important it was that we stop doing this. And as a result of that, Leonard Bierman, a dear friend, George Regas, who had started, Jim Lawson, who had started Death Penalty Focus, asked me to become a member of the board, which I did, and then ultimately became the president of the board, just to be a spokesperson for the issue. But, you know, it's one of those things. when I was doing MASH, I got a call, and this would have been 1975, probably, from a man, minister in Tennessee. And he said, I had signed a petition or something somewhere. He said, I understand you're against the death penalty. And I said, that's correct. And he said, I'm trying to stop it here in Tennessee, and I need your help. Would you come down here and meet with some people? And I said, okay. And he took me to my first visit to death row.
So that was in the 70s. You were,
yeah.
You had been to death row long before Death Penalty Focus then. I didn't realize that. Wow. Because it's no joke to go to death row. That was my next question. Tell me about that and your other many visits to death row. Did that change you, that experience?
Absolutely.
It's life-changing, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. No, I the first one was to Tennessee's death row, and just walking into the, you know, they have this garish yellow chair stationed as a kind of throne to show you what we as the people of Tennessee are capable of doing, strapping people into this god awful thing. And I went into and I met with the guys on the row, and they were all men, and mostly were people of color. And we talked, some of us, I remember, God, you know, some were so angry they wouldn't even look at me. Some were grateful for my being there. Some wanted to talk. This young man gave me, which I still have, a crucifix he had made out of toothpicks, and asked me to take it, to keep it in his memory, which I still have.
Wow, Mike, yeah.
And I went from there to Virginia, where a woman who I had met through Joe, the minister who got me involved initially, she introduced me to a guy, a 20-some-year-old kid in chain, manacles and, you know, chains and, Jesus, stuff that you just can't believe. He came clanking into the room and sat down. And she said, he's innocent in this case, and we have to the only person that can save him is the governor. We have to launch a campaign, and I need your help with this campaign. So we did a campaign in the state of Virginia that ultimately succeeded in getting this man commuted from death to life.
Wow.
Which is, you know, he's still behind bars, and I visited him in I don't know how many prisons over time. But I have to tell you a story. During that time, I was also asked to go on a human rights visit to the Middle East, to you mentioned it, to Israel and the occupied territories, and I met a young man, a lawyer, who lives in Baltimore, and I said, I got a guy on death row in Virginia. You feel like you want to give us a hand? And he said, oh, I'd like to know more about the case and stuff. So he got very deeply involved, and he ultimately wrote the plea that got the governor to sign over and changed his sentence from death to life, which was not satisfactory to us. We wanted him freed, but at least he wasn't being killed. But a garish story, I'll tell you. We were down in the death cell there in Virginia. They had a place where they would take prisoners who were about to be executed to the death chamber. And we were there the day before he was to be killed. And we sat around a table sort of talking strategy about, we haven't heard from the governor, what will happen if we don't, and what will happen if we do. And one of the lawyers looked at me and he said, Mike, Joe, it was this kid, tell Mike about this table we're sitting around. And I looked at him, I didn't know what he was talking about. It's this wooden table. And Joe said, oh, after I'm electrocuted, my body will be too hot to touch, so the guards wearing asbestos gloves will pick me up and carry me out and lay me out on this table so the body will cool. And I thought, honest to God,
you're insane, God.
This is beyond my comprehension. So that night, the Rick, the attorney that I mentioned that I'd met in the Middle East or on the trip, went down. He said, I need Joe's signature on this document in order to get the governor. We've got the governor to agree, but Joe had to agree to the terms. And Joe said, no, I won't sign that. And if he didn't, he was going to die. And Joe, Rick said to the guard, he said, who's in that cell over there? And the guard said, that cell is empty. And he said, okay, if this son of a bitch doesn't sign this thing, I'm going to kill him. and you're going to have to put me in that cell next door. You get into this kind of morose.
Yeah, I get it. I know. You think, it's amazing.
But so Joe finally signed it, and Joe was then another 20 years in jail, and we finally got him out a few years before he passed away.
That's great. So, thank you for telling me that. I used to visit death row in the 80s a lot. I probably met dozens and dozens of men who all were killed. But I can't go all over the country. But I can't go because, you know, I'm an ex-con now from doing a Plowshares action. I have so many convicted felonies, as you do. And that's because I knew the Jesuits were killed. Like, they were my friends, and they had their heads blown off. Well, after that, you're happy to go hammer on a nuclear weapon, as I did with Phil Berrigan. But, I've had on our program our friends, Sister Helen Brejean and Brian Stevenson, talking about this. And recently, a couple of weeks ago, I get all your materials, and you wrote in your Christmas greeting about 2025,
yeah.
You know, Florida executed 19 people, Alabama, South Carolina, Texas, each killed 5. So in 2025, 47 human beings were killed in 11 states, the highest number in America in 15 years. Yet you said in the title of your Christmas message, the tide is turning. Tell me more.
Well, I think it is. I think what we've seen is that more juries have refused to sentence the people that they're judging to death than have sentenced them to death. That's a new statistic. So juries are beginning to hear it. And the studies show support for the death penalty 20 years ago was in the 70s, 75%. Yeah. Today, it's, according to the last poll, 52%.
It's amazing.
And if you add in the question, and it's a little difficult for us, but if you add in the question of life without parole, life in prison without the possibility of parole as an option, then death goes below, down into the 40s. I don't champion that because I don't believe in life in prison without the possibility of parole either. So it's just important to know that we have brought the death penalty, pro-death penalty vote down to just above 50%. And if we keep struggling at it, and the youth in this country are very, very much opposed to the death penalty and are becoming more active, as we now know, due to the stresses and strains on the system provided by this new craziness in Washington. We're going to be seeing much more activism on the part of young people and much more awareness on the part of young people.
That's so great, Mike. And that's all the fruit of campaigning, organizing, and speaking out. Thank you. Now I want to ask you a question. I just want to ask you to bear with me like everybody has to. I want to throw in or add in Jesus to the mix. And I want to do it in a roundabout way about my story of Mother Teresa, which I don't know if you know. I don't know if you remember it. But in my work over the years, I've always been teaching nonviolence and promoting the nonviolent Jesus. That's how Chris and I knew each other so well. But right after the Jesuits were killed and we were having the Wednesday morning meetings, Governor Dumaken in California, I was at the Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, announced the execution of Robert Harris on death in San Quentin. And I had access to Mother Teresa, and I had this crazy idea. Oh, I'm going to call her, and I'm going to call the Governor Dumaken, and I'm going to ask if he'd talk to her and let her try to talk him out of it, and then I'll hold a press conference. And ha, ha, ha. And it was a Monday night, and I called Mother Teresa, and she picked up the phone in March 1990. It was the scariest moment of my life. I'm going, and I'm a goofball, as you know, and I said, "Hi, Mother Teresa, I'm John. I'm a Jesuit in California. Would you talk to Governor Dumaken and ask him not to kill somebody?" And she said, "What did he do?" Which was, first of all, very interesting. In other words, she wanted to know all about Robert Harris.
Yes, right.
Who had killed those two kids in San Diego.
Right.
Remember all
they
that?
They say eating the hamburgers and all that stuff.
Oh, awful.
Yeah.
And she said, of course, John, I will call him. And I said, can I call you back and then get a statement from you and release it to the press? Yes, of course you can, John. And you tell, I will get all the nuns in the planet to pray for you and for the governor. Oh, great. Okay, so I call the governor. Well, he's kind of screwed either way. If he takes the call, he's got to talk to her. And if he doesn't, he's got to deal with that. And, you know, she went on and prevented. We stopped 8 executions.
Oh,
so I call her back, and I said, Mother Teresa, is John calling again from God? What, did you talk to Governor Duke Mason? Yes, John, I talked to the governor. Did you, what did you tell him? And she goes, Mike, this is my question to you. I never recovered. She goes, I told him to do what Jesus would do. And long pause, Mike, and I said to her, did you tell him not to kill the guy? I got mad at Mother. She goes, no, John, I told him to do what Jesus would do. To which I said, well, why didn't you tell him not to kill the guy? I started yelling at Mother Teresa. And then we kind of came friends because we talked to her. Not because I told him to do what Jesus would do. Well, I thought she was nuts, and it was such a mistake. And so I go outside, and there were 30 press people there, and it was live on CNN because Mother Teresa had never done this before. And the next morning, the LA Times, Conrad, the great art cartoonist, had that cartoon with Mother Teresa on the phone on the left side saying, do what Jesus would do, and Duke Majan on the phone going, yeah, but what would Pilate do?
Oh.
And Duke Majan's number two guy called me and yelled me, called me every name in the book, and the execution was canceled. And she did that many, many times and was great fun and used to laugh at me and tell me all kinds of things. Mike, what would Jesus do? Isn't that great? Actually, what she said was brilliant because it opened the whole thing.
Yep.
Tell me about...
God bless her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was terrific.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So tell me about what would Jesus do? I want to hear in your words. I've talked a lot about this, but I want to hear you say the obvious answer.
Well, clearly that Jesus would lift up his hands and say, stop this, put me in front of him, please, and then do what you would do.
Wow. I thought you were, even so, I still thought you were going to say, he would say, don't kill the guy. But he would say, let the one without sin be the first to throw a stone. And he's the only one without sin. You see what I mean? He prevented the execution of that poor woman in the temple. I always think of Jesus as siding with the condemned and then becoming the condemned. He's a victim of the death penalty. How can any Christian, Mike, in the U.S. support the death penalty?
Well, I don't understand, I must say. I don't understand how anybody, but anyone who believes in Christ and the belief in the Christian philosophy could support the death penalty is simply beyond me.
Mike, what sustains you in this work, this great work over these many decades? How do you keep going? I mean, what did you have, a practice of meditation or friends or... I don't know. I'm asking.
No, I have a deep sense that everybody really needs to be loved. I learned at that house I told you about many years ago, I learned that all human beings want three things: love, attention, and respect. And that has stayed with me all the decades since that time. And I've always come to the understanding, no matter who I faced, no matter what had been done, no matter what the issue was, that we were talking about people who had not received love and attention and respect in their lives, and that there is a way to provide that, to be model that, to be that. It can, it seems to me, make all the difference in the world if we recognize that those broken people, you mentioned Bryan Stevenson, my dear friend, broken people are people who have never had love and attention and respect in their lives.
Oh, thank you, Mike. So we're at the end of our time. Is there, as we close, is there anything else you'd like to add or say maybe a word of encouragement to all our listeners about carrying on the work of justice and peace?
Yes. Love people. People want to be loved, and they want to be respected, and they want attention paid. And I adore what you're doing with this show, John, and I listened in with great love to your interview with Joan Baez.
Wasn't that fun? Oh, my
God. Oh, God. It was fabulous.
And she read a poem and then sang me a song. And I'm going, life is good, you know, Mike. And she's all concerned about it afterwards. I know she's not listening, so I'll say this, that, you know, oh, I hope I don't think I supported nonviolence enough. I said, no, you were great. You shared with us your struggle. Remember when she said she has a short temper? It was great. It was great. Well, you must know her. She's just an incredible human being.
Oh, she is.
Yeah.
She
so is. Many of our friends, you know. That's one thing people don't know. I mean, you and I have met the greatest people in the country in this world.
Oh,
it's just... Yeah. I mean, Thomas Merton was right. You get involved with this, and it's the relationships, like Helen Prejean, I mean, Brian Stevenson.
Oh,
my God. These are saints that'll live on in history, and
absolutely.
They're our friends.
Absolutely.
Like Chris Panette, too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You remember what I said when you were there, when we had this small meeting around Jim's passing, Jim Lawson's passing? And I said, I'll never forget, we were in a situation where Jim was talking to a man who was just intent on supporting the death penalty because death, you know, for this particular person was appropriate. And Jim said, this person behaved in a manner that's unacceptable. Does that suggest you mean that God made a mistake?
Yeah.
I thought that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's Jim Lawson and all our great friends, and that's reason enough to keep going. Mike Farrell, thank you so much for speaking with me today, and maybe we can do it again someday. Let me just conclude here and just say thank you to all our listeners for being on this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. You can hear many other podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org, and there also offer a donation to support this free work and maybe receive our, if you want to sign up to get our free e-blast with news about upcoming podcasts and Zooms. And if you can, leave some feedback or at least tell everybody you know about the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus and see you next time. Thanks again, Mike Farrell.
My great pleasure, John. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you.